case in Ray Cook versus the Honorable Judge District Judge Wiebe, Administrative District Judge Wiebe. Ms. Cook, thank you for joining us here today. And Mr. Reed, you are on mute if you don't realize that. There you go. Are there any preliminary matters prior to your arguments?
I have none, Your Honor. Thank you.
Hi, Your Honor.
Very well. Ms. Cook, we will listen to your argument, madam.
Thank you very much. Thank you all so very much for taking up my case today. It means a great deal to me. I may at some point turn off my video just because there's a lag and I don't want that to be distracting. So if I do that, that's just for that reason. But I want to thank you all for taking this matter seriously and for respecting this process. I know that you respect each and every person's access to the courts and their constitutional rights. And while I do have some culpability for simply not knowing how to act as my own attorney in my divorce case, that is where my culpability ends. And today I bring this matter to you because I'm very concerned that there's been an abuse of discretion by declaring me a vexatious litigant in this matter. As you can see from my briefs, the standard by which I would ask the court to sorry, can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry about that.
No problem.
The standard by which I would ask the court to evaluate this case is an abuse of discretion. And the key case which I believe the court should rely on is Rose v. Idaho. And in that court case, while Ms. Rose was arguably found to be a vexatious litigant, the court determined four factors about which the court must find those a person to be vexatious litigant. When a district court seeks to impose pre-filing restrictions, they must, number one, give litigants notice and an opportunity to oppose the order before it's entered. Number two, compile an adequate record for appellate review, including a listing of all the cases and motions that led the district court to conclude that a vexatious litigant order was needed. Number three, make substantive findings of frivolousness or harassment. And number four, tailor the order narrowly as to closely fit the specific vice encountered. And I would present to you today that those things were not met. First and foremost, which is number one, this is the least of the offenses here, but I was not given an opportunity to oppose the order. Within the time frame, I asked specifically twice to have that ability. I filed a receipt of response. The court argued that I did not pay the postage to receive the order by mail, and that seems to have been the problem. As is clear in the record, the reason why I had this case come before me was because I had been acting as my own attorney and I had never ever before had to pay postage for this type of thing. It had always just come to me automatically. And in fact, since then, in representing myself for the past 2 years, I have still not had to pay postage on any other matter. So I just want to bring that to the court's attention. I did file a response, which was not given any merit or any weight in any arguments by Mr. Reed or the other opposing counsel. More importantly, the second point is very important here. The court is required to compile an adequate record for appellate review, including a listing of all the cases and motions that led to the district court to conclude that a vexatious litigant order was needed. If you will notice, I originally asked to be included in the record all of the cases which Judge Wiebe mentioned to declare me a vexatious litigant. Those were not included. And so on May 4th, end of April, I filed a verified objection to the clerk's record and request for additions and said that all of those documents should have been part of the record. I paid for those. I subsequently lost my job. This has affected every area of my life.
And so I asked for those to be added. And on May 8th, I tried to notice this up for hearing. I contacted the court, and the person to deny my fee waiver was the respondent. So in my view, the respondent intentionally suppressed the evidence, which would have allowed me to prove my case, which is a clear abuse of jurisdiction. She denied my fee waiver, saying that there wasn't enough information, but refused to tell me what information I needed to provide. I provided all of the information in the court document that was filed. I called the court. No one could tell me anything. And so though the court doesn't have an adequate record because the respondent herself denied the ability for me to provide that. Not only should it have been included in the first place, but I did my due diligence to make sure that the court had that record. And then when I wasn't able to pay the fee, the respondent abused her jurisdiction and denied my fee waiver request. The third point here is that substantive findings of frivolousness or harassment must be found. As you can see in my brief, there in zero court proceedings has any judge ever in the history of anything that is mentioned here said that my actions were frivolous or harassing. In fact, there are two prongs here. Number one is my divorce case, which is divorce and contempt motion. And number two were petitions for protection orders for both myself and my children based on substantive abuse, which is factual, which occurred. My stepson was removed from my ex-husband's home and is permanently in foster care because of that abuse that occurred. My children have been abused. I was abused by my ex-husband. All of that is a factual basis. There is nothing that has been disputed as far as the abuse goes. Those all occurred. Each and every time I submitted a petition for protection order, it was based on protecting myself, my children, and our safety. And or because I was being harassed by my ex-husband's girlfriend, who continues to do that to this day. So what has happened is that zero court has ever said, this is frivolous, etc. There are certain times where I filed a motion, an ex parte order for civil protection order was issued. That expired and I did not attend the 2-week extension hearing to get a petition, to get a permanent one, either because I thought that behavior was stopping or because things were in motion from the criminal aspect of a court case. And so at least twice, I wasn't able to get out of work to travel across the state to attend those hearings. So at no time were these actually adversely filed against me. The respondent and her attorney argue that I said that Judge Wiebe should have considered the reasons underlying what the adverse civil protection decisions were as part of her analysis, but that's not what I've argued at all. I've argued, number one, that the decisions were not adverse, that they were temporary, or that we didn't have proceedings to make a determination. And number two, that she did not follow the required tests to do so. She didn't look over the merits of each of those cases and determine whether it was adverse or not. And when something simply expires, or in one instance when it was dismissed without prejudice because there was not enough forensic evidence on either side, that is not adverse to me, and that is not a basis to be called declared a vexatious litigant. Additionally, the respondent argued that I included no documents in the record, but again, I've addressed that the respondent herself actually suppressed my ability to be able to do that. So in my view, there have been absolutely zero findings of frivolousness or harassment, especially from the angle of the civil protection order. From the other angle, the divorce aspect, I want to be as respectful as possible with respect to what happened here, but the judge in my case was Judge Gary DeMeyer, And on April 4th, 2018, he held a trial for contempt on in a case in which I, it had to do with the investigation for child abuse in which my stepson was removed. And I listened to Caldwell police officer detectives who told me that if I sent my children to their father's home, that they would charge me with injury to a child for sending them to my ex-husband's home while he was under investigation for abuse. Judge DeMeyer refused to allow me to have anyone testify. And so the only person in the room was the person who agreed or admitted to abusing the child. So I attempted to call that witness. Judge DeMeyer said, I don't think she's going to be available to testify, nudged his chin upward, and she left the room. I attempted to have that audio recording into the record of this proceeding, and was not able to do so. Following that trial, having it...
Cook, what do you mean by that, you were unable to do so?
When I tried to include... It's part of my verified objection to the clerk's record and request for additions. And that was part of, I asked for that recording as well as the transcript to be included in this record so the court could review that. And that was denied by the respondent. So after that trial occurred, I was absolutely outraged because Judge DeMeyer told me on several occasions when I was testifying next to him, you can invoke your right to the Fifth Amendment over and over and over. And I did not understand why he kept telling me that. And so I finally said, okay, I invoke my right to the Fifth Amendment. And he declared the trial over and found me guilty of contempt. I was not able to even testify for myself, call witnesses, nothing. So I was outraged and I went into the trial court administrator's office, which was where Judge Wiebe was acting at that time. And that's where I assumed this began. I didn't know what to do. So on April 5th, I filed a motion to vacate the divorce trial, which was my motion. It was my petition. They told me that was filed. April 6th, the courthouse was closed because they were transitioning to iCourt. And so I couldn't see what was filed, what was not filed. And then the following Monday was April 9th, which was the trial that was supposed to be vacated. And so this entire process was me trying to clean up and figure out what to do after this unimaginable circumstance happened in my divorce case and where I was found guilty of contempt.
Ms. Cook, I didn't understand your point about Judge Wiebe's presence in the trial court administrator's office.
So her secretary was named Tara Hill, and she is the one that I went to and said, what do I do? I don't even know what to do. How does this happen? And she said she would get back with me, and at no one would return my phone calls. And so the next time I heard from someone was from Judge Wiebe that I would have to file a complaint with the Idaho ISC, the
Idaho Judicial Council.
Yes, thank you, the Idaho Judicial Council. And she's the one that told me that I had to do that. And that's where she factored in. So that... I think that's how she was notified of where this all began. But
Ms.
I think that
Ms. Cook, I have a question about the filings that are listed by the district judges as examples of you engaging in vexatious conduct. Were all of those filed while you were representing yourself, or were any of those filed while you were represented by counsel?
So I'd have to look at the list. Let me grab that really fast. But I think most of them were filed shortly after that trial date of April. So that was April 4th, 2018 was the date that occurred. So anything prior to that date, I was represented by counsel. The issue was that I was unable to pay my attorney's. My attorney demanded $10,000 and I wasn't able to pay him. And so I was scraping the money together. He filed a notice to withdraw. I objected to that and said that my trial date was too close and I couldn't do this by myself. And Judge DeMeyer denied my objection and allowed him to withdraw, and he would not allow me to have enough time to call my own witnesses, to get my subpoenas out, nothing within that time frame. And so that's when I tried to get the trial moved. He would not allow me to continue the trial to a later date. And then it unfolded that way in April 2018.
So, Ms. Cook, do you know the date on which Judge DeMeyer said your lawyer would be relieved of representing you?
I believe it was, I don't have it with me, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
So normally there's a stay imposed to enable you to obtain other counsel or let the court know how you're going to proceed.
Yes, Your Honor, and that was the basis for my objection. And these are the things that I would have liked to include in the record for you, but I tried to do so, but the respondent denied my ability to prepare this in the record for you. So I would have had all of this information for you so that you could see clearly, how this unfolded. But unfortunately, I've been denied that ability to present an adequate record. And that is one of the components that is required for you to find me a vexatious litigant, is that you have an adequate record on appeal to be able to determine that. And the court has simply just not allowed me to. I don't understand why Judge Wiebe was the one who is able to make the determination of whether my fee waiver should be denied or approved. So I'll finish with my last argument here, and then I'd like to yield the rest of my time for my rebuttal. But the fourth piece here is that in Rose v. Idaho is that the order must be tailored narrowly so as to closely fit the specific vice encountered. And this order denies my access to the courts whatsoever. It says I may not file any new litigation. And I have not filed any litigation against anyone ever, except to protect from my children, my safety, my children's safety, and to act as my own attorney when I didn't even want to. I just had to because I was poor. And this order denies my ability to have access to the courts entirely. So it has not been tailored. I have to file any new litigation whatsoever in the state of Idaho. I have to seek approval from the court. And more importantly, what I find very alarming is that these issues are an issue of safety, and there is a reason for ex parte orders of civil protection. And for me to have to go and get approval from the court in order to get an ex parte order to protect my children is defeats the purpose. To this day, my daughter just told me 2 weeks ago that she was locked in the garage when she was visiting her father the last time, that she was locked in the garage for more than 20 minutes at a time. And there's nothing I can do because I cannot apply to protect my child. So I have to rely on law enforcement.
Ms. Cook, in fairness, the order that was issued in this case and the provisions of Idaho Court Administrative Rule 59 do provide, as you alluded to a moment ago, an opportunity to petition the court for permission to file something. Have there been any instances where you attempted to file something and asked permission to do so, but were denied?
No, Your Honor, I have not. I just got permission to file some new litigation and was approved. So that's the only time that I have done so.
Related to this case?
That's with respect to my divorce. My ex-husband took the children and took them out of school and moved to Utah and said Well, most people's ex-wives are not vexatious litigants. So he has essentially weaponized this declaration against me to try to gain advantage in our divorce case and do whatever he wants to do. So he removed them from school, removed them from the state. And so I received approval to file new litigation in the divorce case, which I have not yet done.
Was it Judge Beebe that granted that request?
No, I filed it in Judge Wiebe's court and it sat there and nothing happened. And so I filed it in the magistrate court and that was approved. I'll yield the rest of my time for my rebuttal argument. Thank you.
Mr. Reed, on behalf of the respondent.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Your Honors, this is a straightforward application of Rule 59. The ADJ here, Judge Wiebe, made the required findings under Rule 59, and the appellant was afforded all the procedure that's required by the rule. And so we would ask the court to affirm the pre-filing order. There are three different topics that I'd like to discuss. Briefly, I'd like to go over the standard of review once more, and in particular with regard to giving deference to the findings of fact.
I would like to ask one question in relation to the April 2018 dates mentioned by Ms. Cook. When was Judge DeMeyer suspended from his job?
I don't think I have that information right in front of me, Your Honor.
All right, I'll find it. Thank you.
I apologize. I know of certain cases in which the appellant was acting pro se, but I don't have necessarily the dates for the withdrawal.
No. The judge. When was the judge taken off of his job in 2018?
I'm sorry. I don't have that information before me.
Thank you. I'll find out.
So I'd like to start with just talking briefly about the standard of review. And then I'd like to just...
Mr. Reed, before you go there.
Yes.
Ms. Cook has pointed out some federal authority, Ringgold, Lockhart versus the County of Los Angeles and the Rose v. Idaho cases that suggests that there may be a federal constitutional right to both substantive findings and narrow tailoring of an order once one finds a vexatious litigant. And I'm wondering if you'd like to comment on the interrelationship between those federal cases and our rule, which doesn't seem to include those requirements.
Yes, Justice Stegner. So first of all, the first principle to remember is what's stated in Eisman versus Miller, which is that a pre-filing order does not remove a person's right to access to the courts. And so that addresses the constitutional concern. But with regard to the federal standards that have been discussed, those federal standards, they stem from a Ninth Circuit case, DeLong versus Hennessy, and that case is applying the All Writs Act under United States law, which is an act that applies only to the courts, as it says, that are established by act of Congress. And so
Ringgold Lockhart versus the City of Los Angeles talks about First Amendment rights as far as access to the courts are concerned. It doesn't talk about the All Writs Act. I'm trying to understand the interplay between our federal courts' determinations, including Judge Lodge's decision in Rose versus Idaho, in which he, I think, followed Ringgold Lockhart and found that there had to be substantive findings and the order had to be narrowly tailored. And I'm trying to understand the interplay between our Rule 59 and the First Amendment and the determination by the federal courts that there are substantive rights that need to be addressed in an order finding someone a vexatious litigant.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, under Rule 59, there is a requirement that there be findings made. Substantive findings.
But they don't require the judge to go into the files and look at the cases and make a determination of substantive frivolity or whatever the word is, or harassment. And that's what I'm concerned about is, it seems to me in Judge Wiebe's order that she simply said, the rule says if there are more than three within a certain time period and the pro se litigant loses those, then that's enough as far as Rule 59 is concerned. And I'm not sure that Rule 59 addresses the constitutional rights that have been articulated in by either the Ninth Circuit or on U.S. District Judge.
Well, Your Honor, that's one of the criteria for becoming a vexatious litigant is the D1 criteria that you were mentioning about just having three prior in the last 7 years determined against you. But there is also the other criteria that Judge Wiebe found do apply, and those require the judge to determine whether or not there were unmeritorious motions or other tactics used that are frivolous or solely intended to cause unnecessary delay. And so under sub D3, which Judge Wiebe also found applied, there is a requirement to look at least enough to know whether or not there were unmeritorious motions or other tactics that were frivolous. And so in Judge Wiebe's decision, she did go over multiple instances that would fit that standard. Everything from attempting to relitigate issues that had already been finally determined multiple times by motion, delay tactics such as filing frivolous motions and then vacating the hearings, failing to appear for hearings, failing to meet deadlines in cases in which the appellant had brought those forward. And then, of course, the constant, as she says, the constant filing of protection orders while the divorce was in process. And so she was able to look at, from a substantive standpoint, whether or not those were frivolous or were solely intended to cause unnecessary delay. And she found that D3 did apply in this case. And so if there is a constitutional concern with that, then at least in this case, it's met by the ADJ's findings of fact.
Well, let's address the additional constitutional concern, though, raised by the cases that Justice Stegner has just brought up, and that's the concern about narrowly tailoring the solution. As currently constituted, our Rule 59 basically says, even if in just one narrow case involving the same parties, someone engages in conduct which fits the rule, they can be barred from total access to the courts, without court approval, of course, on a wide range of types of cases. Do you think the type of order that was issued in this case, where the whole history of this appellant is related solely to the divorce and the ancillary matters related to the divorce, do you think it's narrowly tailored to allow a order to go into effect that would prevent her from filing a small claims action in an unrelated thing, or perhaps filing a pleading in a lawsuit that for personal injury? I mean, it would just seem to me that there might be an issue there.
Well, first of all, as you've mentioned, the narrow tailoring requirement isn't in our rules.
Right.
And it could be, but it's not at this point. I think the important thing in this case is to look at the totality of all of the conduct that Judge Wiebe took into account. It stemmed everything from filing those protection orders to other motions and practices during the divorce. It happened to all happen around one kind of case, but nevertheless, there was a wide variety of different kinds of conduct that met the standards of Rule 59. And so as far as this case is concerned, I think there is an indication that it goes beyond just one particular kind of conduct. And so narrow tailoring to say, well, you can't file protection orders or you can't file motions, that wouldn't cover the spectrum of what conduct occurred here. And
sorry to interrupt you, but wouldn't a divorce action be the classic example of something, though, that I think Ms. Cook a few moments ago during her argument used the word outraged. The emotion and things that are involved in a family law, domestic relations type case can often cause people to lose a lot of perspective. Many of us have had the privilege of representing people in a divorce action and know how difficult that can be sometimes. And the bad behavior we may see from our clients and opposing side may not be indicative of how they behave in their everyday life and other types of pursuits that might bring them to court. So again, in a case like this, are we really throwing the baby out with the bathwater, if you will, by barring her from all types of civil actions?
Well, one thing that I'd like to point out is that this idea of outrage and emotion isn't confined just to this kind of case. Almost any kind of civil case that you can see can have a similar kind of outrage or emotional response. I mean, there are cases over land use, there are cases over a lot of different things that bring up this and can result in this kind of behavior. And so I think that that just because this was in the circumstances of one divorce doesn't necessarily mean that same conduct couldn't spread to something else. Now, again, I would defer to the court about whether or not there should be a rule requiring narrow tailoring. I don't necessarily think that there's any Idaho case law to this point that requires that narrow tailoring, that says that Idaho Rule 59 for some reason violates the Constitution because it doesn't require that. But again, I would defer to the court about whether or not that should be a rule. And I would just...
Isn't that the question Ms. Cook raises? She says, I have a federal constitutional right to access the courts, and the Ninth Circuit and the U.S. District Court for the District of Idaho has determined that the law, as it relates to one's access, requires both substantive findings and narrow tailoring. And it hasn't been that long ago since James versus the City of Boise, when the United States Supreme Court said, when it comes to federal law, the Idaho Supreme Court is bound to apply federal law as it's determined by federal courts. And I'm concerned that she's raised a bona fide constitutional issue, and I'm concerned that our rule doesn't address what it needs to address. And I'm trying to understand the interplay between, I know we don't have a United States Supreme Court decision articulating federal law, but I think we have pretty good authority from the Ninth Circuit articulating federal law as it relates to the First Amendment. And I'm wondering, do we get to just ignore that?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that this court can ignore precedent from the United States Supreme Court with regard to the Constitution. I think that in this case, however, it would be necessary to have the standard pre-filing order because of the wide spectrum of conduct at issue. I think if this were a more narrow set of facts, that perhaps that concern would be more heightened. If this was just, for example, filing motions in the divorce, or just, for example, filing protective orders, there'd be a difference. But the kind of conduct is much more wide-ranging than that in this case. And so I think Judge Wiebe made the correct determination that the pre-filing order under Rule 59 was required in this case.
For all litigation brought by Ms. Cook?
Yes, Your Honor. Just based on the standards, based on the determinations that the ADJ made, her findings of fact, she had the facts in front of her and she was able to make that determination. And those findings of fact, she's afforded deference so long as those findings of fact are not clearly erroneous.
And is there a suggestion that Ms. Cook has filed lawsuits against anyone other than her ex-husband or in relation to her divorce from her ex-husband?
I think, again, I would just go back to the general principles again, that the point of these pre-filing orders is to make sure that the court doesn't, isn't, as Eisman says, hamstringed by unnecessary conduct that takes too much of the court's resources. And so I would say that if there's a pattern of this kind of conduct, that the pre-filing order was appropriate.
What about the duration of such an order? It doesn't appear that Rule 59 addresses a way to get relief from that. Is Ms. Cook forever barred from access to the Idaho court without permission from some screening judge?
Your Honor, I think you're correct in saying that there's no requirement. I'm just checking the rule right now, that there's no duration requirement. And I don't know that it, I haven't looked into this issue particularly, but I don't know that there's any specific rule that addresses taking that pre-filing order off.
So given the specific nature of her abuses in this case, which all appeared to be related to an ex-husband and the ancillary issues of a divorce, she's forever barred from accessing the courts. in all ways without court approval. Do you think that would also fit a narrow tailoring requirement?
Well, I think if for example, she's required forever without any chance or any opportunity to ask to have that taken off, then that might be a little bit broad. But I don't know that she's necessarily, that she couldn't necessarily bring an action a few years down the road asking to have that order lifted. Again,
the rule certainly doesn't provide for that though, right?
That's correct. Yeah, it doesn't specifically say it. But I can't think of any reason why some kind of extraordinary writ or other kind of action like that couldn't accomplish that goal. And then the ADJ would have the same kind of determination as she did here, whether or not there's reason. If, for example, after a 7-year period, there's no unmeritorious litigation, then the judge might decide that in her discretion, there's no reason to keep an order if it's based solely on D1, for example, right? And so—
Ms. Cook's only recourse to challenge Judge Wiebe's order, the method in which she has challenged it, is, and that's to bring an appeal. If she waited until the 43rd day after that order is issued, does she have the ability to collaterally attack a judgment of a court that has a court of competent jurisdiction?
I think this court has the right to administer the courts of the state. And so I think this court has the authority to take an extraordinary action if it's required and if it's needed, especially under something like a court administrative rule. So I think if all else fails, this court has that authority.
How would she access this court outside of an appeal?
Again, if there was some kind of, I haven't really looked into this issue, but I imagine that there might be some kind of extraordinary writ that could be filed before this court that would bring it before this court.
Sorry, I dropped my bottle.
So, so again, I'd just like to go over quickly.
I'd like to ask one question.
Yes.
If you know, when was the motion for relief from the order of Judge Wiebe filed? And when was it responded to? Do you have those dates?
The motion for relief from Judge Wiebe's
vexatious litigant order. It has been indicated by Ms. Cook. She asked that that order be reconsidered and or lifted. She sent it to Judge Wiebe. It was not answered. And I want to know when, in fact, it was answered and by whom.
May I clarify, Your Honor?
Hold on, madam. I'll ask you that question when you have a chance to talk.
Okay.
So the information that I have is that the initial order was filed on the 30th, that the final order issued on the 17th, that later that day, the appellant's response was issued. And I believe it was at the end of that month. Let me find the date that there was a motion for reconsideration.
December 31st.
Thank you. The motion for reconsideration. And then the court took up that motion for reconsideration and issued an opinion, I believe, in January.
And who did that? Judge Wiebe?
Yes.
Or another judge?
January 31st was the order denying motion to reconsider. Signed by Judge Wiebe, I believe. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. So, Judge, that's one other point. Judge Wiebe does mention in her decision that she doesn't feel that in these circumstances she's actually a respondent in the same way that a defendant is a defendant, that she has jurisdiction over the issue, but there's no conflict of interest if the judge who's assigned to decide the issue decides the issue and has the ability to make the determinations, the pretrial kind of determinations such as motions, the record, things like that. That's within her authority to do that.
Does the record contain any information regarding the Ms. Cook's subsequent request? I've seen the notice of appeal and it does in fact designate or request that documents related to her filings, the filings that were the basis of the vexatious litigant order, be included. And then we've heard from Ms. Cook that she in fact filed a motion for, and I don't know this how the motion was styled, but a motion for a fee waiver. Is there anything in the record that pertains to those proceedings?
Your Honor, if I can have just a moment, I will take a quick look. I believe that the clerk's record does include the motion for fee waiver.
Okay.
I'll just have to quickly look through, but
that's all right. I won't waste your time. I just didn't see it. So.
Yeah. I thought that it was on the case sheet. It's listed as being in the record. And so she did ask for that. If I remember correctly, there was a request for a fee waiver. There's a request to augment the record, and that request was partially approved and partially denied. As to the denial, I believe it was because of an ask for a fee waiver that was denied on that. So briefly, if I could, I'd just like to quickly talk about the timing issue of when the issue ordered and when the appellant was able to file her response. Again, under Rule 59E, there are 14 days to respond after the order issues. And the record is clear that the appellant did not respond within those 14 days. The record also is clear that she received the order on December 6th, and you'll find that on page 34 in the record, that she admits that she received the order. So any time from December 6th until supposedly December 14th, the appellant could have asked for an extension of time or filed the response. The record doesn't include any such response or request for an extension of time in that time frame. On the 17th, the final order issued. And about an hour or so later, according to the stamp on the filing stamp, was when the motion for further time, a response was filed by the appellant, and then of course the motion for reconsideration. And so under Rule 59, all the appropriate procedural protections were there. The 14 days were given and plus three more days. And then in addition to that, the court took up the appellant's arguments when it decided the motion for reconsideration. And so I think the procedural issue, I think, is pretty clear in the record that there's no procedural problem there. And then just briefly, I'll go over again the three different bases by which Judge Wiebe found that the appellant should be subject to a pre-filing order. First, D1, the appellant found that there were more than three pro se litigations determined against the appellant. And I'd just like to note that there's no authority that I'm aware of for the proposition that a civil protection order is not a litigation for purposes of Rule 59. Secondly, Judge Wiebe found that the appellant repeatedly attempted to relitigate an issue that was finally determined against her when she filed multiple objections and other motions having to do with her divorce. And third, Judge Wiebe found that the appellant repeatedly filed unmeritorious motions and engaged in other tactics that were frivolous and solely intended to cause unnecessary delay. As I mentioned earlier, the attempts to relitigate, the multiple motions that were filed and then vacated, failing to appear for hearings that she had initiated, as well as missing filing deadlines, and then the constant filing of protection orders during the divorce. And so if you look at the findings of Judge Wiebe all in total, there are three different bases by which the pre-filing order was appropriate, and Judge Wiebe's findings of fact and her order were substantial enough to support her decision that a final pre-filing order should be issued in this case. And so we would ask again that the court apply the standards in Idaho Rule 59 as they're laid out to give deference to the findings of fact of the AEJ that are supported by evidence as we've discussed, and to affirm the pre-filing order. Thank you.
How much time does Ms. Cook have?
10 minutes, Your Honor.
All right. Ma'am, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the main point I want to make here are two things. First of all, the rule is not sufficient, obviously. I think that is clear. And the past court guidance has used these federal cases or ninth district cases to create some substantiation or some variance there to make the rule more applicable or have more, I guess, less arbitrary. And so in Rose v. Idaho, one of the findings they made was, as to the core finding of frivolousness or harassment, courts should examine both the number and content of the litigant's cases or claims to determine whether they are patently without merit. And my argument is that Judge Wiebe did not review that. And if I had been able to show you the evidence, I would show you why that if she had reviewed the evidence, she could not have come to that conclusion. My problem, the basis for this entire thing is that my case was completely destroyed by a judge that was subsequently removed from his duty. In April 2018, he told me to invoke my right to the Fifth Amendment. He would not allow me to call witnesses. I was trying very, very hard to rectify my case and to bring it back together. It was not intended to cause delay, harassment. I was trying to rectify a situation which was severely blown out of proportion and a very egregious way of having a case go on. And so there is no way that she could have come to that conclusion had she looked at the facts. And the fact that she has now suppressed all of you from being able to have that material shows, I think, an abuse of discretion that she would deny my fee waiver. The whole entire reason why I was not able to pay was because someone posted that I'm a vexatious litigant on every political board in the entire state. I filed that evidence as well in one of my pleadings. And I subsequently lost a contract. I lost all of my income. This has dramatically affected every part of my life, and it's very, very serious. So I want you to understand that in no way, shape, or form did I ever try to harass or delay the court system. I was trying to rectify a situation in which I was the victim of a case that did not go as planned. And when I tried to go to the trial court administrator's office to find a solution, they told me to vacate the hearing. And then I'm accused of not showing up to a hearing because it wasn't vacated. So I don't know what other options I have to do. I've brought this before you because this is the only avenue in which I have to try to correct any of this. There has been so much that I feel I've served 2 years of unsupervised probation for protecting my children, being found in contempt for protecting my children and listening to a Caldwell police officer. I have no access to the courts. I have no ability to do anything without approval of a judge. And this declaration is such a negative light, cast such a negative light on me that it affects my business. It affects my ability to parent. It's weaponized by my ex-husband. He has tried to convince their schools and counselors that I'm a vexatious litigant that is just trying to harass people. And it's nothing of the sort. So I would ask you that you please, please, please consider my petition to have this declaration taken away. And that if there is some offending action that I have done, that an order is tailored to my offending action. I certainly have learned a lot through this process, but it's never been my attempt to waste the court's time in any way, shape, or form. And so—
You just mentioned something that I want to follow up on. That is that you've been on probation for 2 years?
Yeah, I served 2 years of unsupervised probation for being found in contempt of keeping my children from their father, according to the police's, they told me I had to, or they would charge me with injury to a child. And so that was the
The trial that was held on April 4th, 2018 was that contempt trial. And that's when Judge DeMeyer told me to invoke my Fifth Amendment. He just told me to invoke the Fifth Amendment.
And he placed you on probation for 2 years?
I did, yeah.
And was that supervised or unsupervised?
It was unsupervised, and I just completed that 2 years probation.
And did you, were you obliged to pay cost of supervision? Or
no.
Any fees or charges that incurred as a result of that?
No, I was not, no. And Your Honor, I will say one last thing about this is when this vexatious litigant declaration came down, I was absolutely shocked. I thought there was absolutely no way that that could ever happen. And I was right in the middle of appealing the divorce and the contempt case. And this was such an emotional, it was so emotionally destructive that I could not proceed on my appeals. It was very emotionally overwhelming. So it's affected everything. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cook.
Ms. Cook, when was the order on the finding of contempt in the 2 year probation? What date, if you know?
April. So he found me guilty immediately after I evoked my Fifth Amendment right, as he told me to, which was April 4th, 2018. And that he said that he would do sentencing on April 9th. And that was the date of the hearing or of the first date of trial for my divorce. And so I tried to vacate that on the 5th. They told me it was vacated. And so I didn't know it was occurring at all. And so I asked for the sentencing hearing to be rescheduled another date. So he just, he granted my husband my children and everything the 9th and found me guilty of contempt on the 9th. My husband didn't even ask for my children. He didn't ask for my house. He gave him everything, gave him custody of my kids, gave him all the property. I got all the debt. That's it.
Thank you. Anything further by any of the justices? At this point in time, this matter is now under advisement. We thank you, Ms. Cook, as well as Mr. Reed, for appearing here today, and we will render a decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.